Thank you, Mr. Patchinger, and good morning to all. First, I'd like to extend an apology to Tim Henry and Kathy. I'm not sure what happened as far as notification about his dad's death. I did get the email from him this past week and recall sitting down to write something, but several of you have mentioned you didn't receive anything from me, so I'm not sure what happened, but I will go back and try to find out what occurred there and wonder what else hasn't gone out that was supposed to. So my apologies to them, because I fully intended to let all of you know about that. He lived a full life, 96, wasn't he, Tim? Something like that. So an amazingly long life, but somehow it just doesn't quite register for a while. I'm sure you can all appreciate that and extend your comfort and condolences to Tim and Kathy. One of the great opportunities about the Winter Family Weekend, which in one way is similar in that regard to the Feast of Tabernacles, for those of us who are pastors, is the chance to actually sit and listen to messages given by other ministers. I would add to that that in addition to being a blessing for pastors, it's probably a blessing for pastors' wives too, in that they can sit and listen to other ministers give messages. You do realize that she has to listen to the same one twice most Sabbaths. And I've never discovered her carrying earplugs with her. I wouldn't say that it's impossible that such a thing could happen. As we're driving in the car and I speak to her and she goes, "What?" Then I think that might be a clue, but that hasn't happened yet. Sometimes at the feast or at the winter weekend or times like that, we find ourselves jotting down ideas, I speak for myself, from the messages that we can later craft into a sermon on a related topic or on a facet of what the speaker was talking about. We all have different styles, so it's not a simple matter to just import a message in its entirety to use and to give in our local areas, for example. I've discovered, for example, that while my brother and I are very similar in many ways, my brother Dave, it's very hard for me. I'm not sure how it works for him. He has on occasion asked if I could send him some notes I had on a particular topic. I'm not sure what use he makes of them, presumably non-heretical, but I don't know if he has to rework the notes completely or how they work for him. I know that when I've gotten material from him on rare occasions, it really doesn't work. He has a totally different style of putting his notes down than I do. And so I might get some ideas, but then I just have to set it aside and start over. That's not always true. There are a handful of ministers I've discovered who seem to be kindred spirits, that when they put something down, it's in a format that I find accessible, and with just a few odd edits here and there, or maybe even not so odd edits, it comes across and I can use it. And that happens once in a while. It happened that way this past year in Louisville, and apparently not just for me, because when I asked the other minister in question about using his material, he chuckled and said he couldn't very well refuse me, because he'd already shared it with at least two or three others who had asked him for a set of notes. That was Mr. Kylo's presentation this year at one of the seminars. It was not the sermon, of course, that you heard. All of you heard that, except for the part that was a glitch in the transmission. But Mr. Kylo had a seminar on, I believe it was on the Wednesday. Some of you may have already heard this. If you, I know my wife has, because she was there. I'm not sure anybody else here would have. But even if so, hopefully those involved will find the review a good process and helpful too. Mr. Kylo titled his presentation, "Saul, a Man After Man's Own Heart." And of course, you immediately pick up on the connection that, as we know, his successor as king of Israel, King David, is described in the book of Acts as a man after God's own heart. So his presentation was about Saul and about the things we can learn from his example and his experiences and his life as it's portrayed in the scriptures. And I found it particularly helpful, so I asked him if I could have access to his notes, because I thought I could make use of them. As it happened, most of the notes that I had written down during his presentation were reasonably complete, but there's always a little bit extra that you find that you didn't get down. He started, so I'm going to use that material today to learn. Let's see if we can learn some lessons from King Saul's life. We frequently access King David's, but maybe there's something we can pick up from Saul that would be helpful in an opposite way. He started in Philippians 2, verse 5, and it's a verse that's very familiar with us. It says in verse 5 of Philippians 2, "Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus." Now, we've read that hundreds of times, I'm sure. But the more you read it, the more you think about it, the more deeply profound it becomes. As we heard at the winter weekend, if you don't let Christ's mind be in you, that's what the verse says, let this mind be in you. If we don't, then the problem is that other minds will be in us. And that's the difficulty. So that's the other side of the coin. If we don't let Jesus Christ's mind be in us, what other minds might be? Then we have a problem. Really what we look at when we look at Saul's life is an example of some fatal flaws of character. David was called a man after God's own heart, but if we call Saul a man after man's own heart, we begin to see part of the problem. The premise, really, about all of this is very simple, and Philippians 2:5 is at the heart of it. Because before we get into the story of Saul, we have to understand the why behind the what. We can read what he did and what he was like, but it would be a lot more helpful if we could understand why. Where was he coming from? What went through his mind? The problem is, and the situation is, that how you and I think is critical. And God's word makes the case that how we think really determines who we are and why and what we do. And that would be the difference then in describing the first two kings of Israel. Whose heart did they take after? We've read many times Romans 8 and verse 6, for example, the verse that says, "For to be carnally minded is death, but to be spiritually minded is life and peace." We've read that also many times. And the next verse goes on to say, "For the carnal mind is enmity against God, the law of God," and so on. We've read those verses. God's Bible, God's Word, is really, when we study it, we're really studying the mind. We're studying how to think. We're studying about how minds are shaped, carnal minds or spiritual minds. What forms them? What shapes them? What guides them? What leads them into the way they are? God's Word is full of instructions on how to think and also sometimes on how not to think. There are stories and episodes and anecdotes about people, and those recollections, those stories are at their core about how people thought or how they didn't think. And that's what we learn. So you and I need to think too a lot about the way we think. What's going on inside here? You know, what's happening upstairs, as we sometimes say. So we have to think about thinking. We have to monitor our thinking. In 2 Corinthians 10, and beginning in verse 3, we read these words, "For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh." We live here in the physical form. We have people all around us who do not recognize and do not understand in what way we are different from them. We appear, as we've find earlier in this same letter of 2 Corinthians, we appear to be connecting on the same level. I'm sure you've had the experience of people who might be very religious in their own approach, thinking that you and they are on the same wavelength. And you know full well you're not, because of a miracle that has been performed in your mind. So though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal. They're not of the flesh. They're not physical. But they're mighty in God for pulling down strongholds, casting down arguments, verse 5, and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ. That is a challenge. At the winter weekend, Mr. Kylo had a couple of presentations on PowerPoint. He had just a handful of slides he put up. At this point, he put up a slide of that famous statue, the Thinker. You know, the guy sitting there thinking, and the caption was, "I think, therefore I am dangerous." And you know, there's some truth to that sometimes. We have been trained to think by the world we live in, by our upbringing, by our culture, by our own habits. I've given a series of sermons a number of times on the Holy Spirit in our lives, and one of the statements that I have made repeatedly is that we have what we might call a programmed past, to use computer terminology. Our past has been programmed in this world. And we tend to go back to that as a default drive unless we are actively and consciously overriding it to think and move in a godly way. That's where we have to come to. So bringing every thought into captivity, like Paul writes to the Corinthians, that's tough. We end up having to put a filter on our thought process, because if we don't, our thinking can go the other direction. Bad thinking can go run away on us. We go into that default mode, into our programmed past. Even in this one chapter of 2 Corinthians 10, Paul hits time and again on issues of thinking that are so common, and we're going to find we're actually part of Saul's fatal flaws as well. We look at verse 7, for example, where he says, "Do you look at things according to the outward appearance?" And the answer is, yes, we do, unless we learn to capture those thoughts and think like God. That's one of the great lessons in Saul's story. You skip down to verse 12. He says, "For we dare not class ourselves or compare ourselves with those who commend themselves. But they, measuring themselves by themselves and comparing themselves among themselves, are not wise." Ask yourself a question. Do we ever compare ourselves among ourselves? Yes, we do. Unless we learn to capture those thoughts and think like God. That's one of the great lessons in Saul's story too. Verse 17 says, "But he who glories, let him glory in the Lord." Ask yourself a question. Do we ever glory in the self or in other things that are not of God? And the answer is, yes, we do. Unless we learn to capture those thoughts and think like God. And that, too, is a lesson from Saul's story. Sometimes people say, "I just wasn't thinking." Is that what they really mean? No, what they mean is, "I was thinking, but I was thinking stupid." You know, when you say, "I just wasn't thinking," what does that mean? Do you mean that there was a complete blank in our minds? That there was nothing going on? That's not usually what we mean. We just mean that we allowed our natural carnal proclivities to take over and run away with us. And so later on, it's easier to say, "Well, I just wasn't thinking." What we mean is, I didn't go to the effort of constructively, positively thinking in a godly manner. That's what we mean. But that doesn't sound so good, so we say, "Well, I just wasn't thinking." Our younger set did catch that, right? You know, I get the forehead slap every week when I come into church, you know, from some of the younger ones who spotted that months and months and months ago. They'll probably put it on my tombstone. There will be a hand slapping the forehead on my tombstone. What exactly is it that is going on in the minds of people that goes on in our minds? Your mind is always working. You know, you even have dreams. You dream about things. And sometimes you wake up and you're either relieved that it was a dream or you're disappointed that it was a dream. And other times you wake up and you know you were dreaming, but you can't remember what it was about. But the mind was still active in one sense. Even your unconscious or subconscious mind might be more accurate. It was thinking, it was processing, it was unraveling things somehow connected to what you were experiencing. And yet we're not always aware of it. Sometimes we find that we can't sleep because our mind just won't shut off. It just won't quiet down. It just keeps going a mile a minute, and you're thinking, "Please, please stop so I can sleep." and sometimes that just happens. So when we read the verse in Philippians, it says, let this mind be in you. What is in the mind? Well, there are lots of important areas of thinking. In his presentation, Mr. Kylo rattled off 23 of them. I don't know that you'll be able to get all of these down, but I found in looking back over my notes that I was pretty close. I'd gotten 22. I'd scrunched two of them together, and I only had 22. So when he said 23, I was searching, but I couldn't find it till I actually had his set of notes. But there were 23 areas he gave that are important areas of thinking. God, you know, what do we think about God? That's important. What about ourselves? That's another important area. How about others? How do we think about others? What about our office or our position, however you want to put it? What do we think about that? What do we think about, in just general terms, power and authority? How does that strike us? What do we think about leading people? We know that that's going to be our job in the millennium, no matter what we do now. What do we think about being led? Are we receptive? Are we responsive? What do we think about choosing leaders? How about developing leadership? Then there's personal accountability. There's also personal responsibility. Then you could have those same two about other people. You could have the accountability of others and the responsibility of others. What about the initiative or the creativity or the success of others? What do you think about that? When somebody else is successful or creative or has initiative, how does that strike you? Does that make you feel threatened? It certainly did Saul. We're going to find that out. It was one of his major problems. What about your own mistakes? We all make them. What about the mistakes of others? How do you deal with that? What do you think about problem solving? How about communicating? You know, is it honest? Is it open? How do we communicate? What do we think about communication? What about receiving input from others? You know, sometimes we go to somebody and we say, just tell me what you think. How did it strike you? And then they're really brutally frank, and you'll say, well, sorry I asked. You know. What about our expectations of other people? What about our expectations of ourselves? How about gratification? How about success? What are your thoughts on success? Now, you may not have gotten them all down, but you probably, if you're writing notes, you probably got quite a few. There were 23 that I listed. Those are all areas that we think about sometimes. We could add some more, I'm sure. But how important are any of those things? Will the way you and I think about them affect our actions and the thoughts and actions of people around us? There is a way that Jesus Christ thought about all these things. And that's why we're told, let this mind be in you. But is that the way we think about these things, the way he would have? Do we always think the way he thought? Well, not always. We want to do that more and more. I hope that that's a regular part of your prayers. I know it is mine to ask God to help me think like he thinks and like his son thinks. Do we let that mind be in us? As Mr. Kylo said, if you don't, there'll be another mind in you, and that's dangerous. Then that's where his PowerPoint slide came in. I think, therefore I am dangerous. Do we let our own thoughts or the thoughts of other people affect us? Well, of course we do. He had another PowerPoint slide at this point. It showed this little fella who looked sort of like those minions from the movies Despicable Me, you know. And it said, don't believe everything you think. And, you know, usually we say, don't believe everything you hear or you read or you see. But this was a little different. Don't believe everything you think. You know, there are so many examples in God's Word. And we need to draw lessons from the lives of the people in this, in those words. But not just what happened to them. What we need to be able to do is look at the principles of the way they thought. Because those core issues don't change in human nature. Some things do, many things do in our technological savvy world. But you know, even, I was going to say 100 years from now, but 10 years from now, people are going to look back and say, boy, how primitive could you get? I mean, all it takes is to pull up a TV show or a movie that was made about 25, 30 years ago and look at what passed for computers 25 years ago. It's hilarious to us now. Things change so rapidly. The examples in the Bible are not just historical stories about other people. We need to read them as lessons for us. That's what Paul said, wasn't it? That everything that happened to them happened as an example. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 11. All these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. He went on to say in verse 12, therefore let him who thinks take heed, or thinks he stands, take heed lest he fall. And he reassures us in the next verse, no temptation has overtaken you except as is common to man. But God is faithful. This is 1 Corinthians 10:13 now. Who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you're able, but with the temptation will also make the way of escape that you may be able to bear it. If we miss what God preserved for us to learn from, we are going to miss something he wanted us to know. We need to access those examples for the purpose of learning how to live in a godly manner, to make the most of the lessons of the past. You know, sometimes people say experience is the best teacher, but I really seriously disagree with that. It's an effective teacher, but actually learning from somebody else's experience would be a far better teacher, wouldn't it? And not have to go through it yourself. One of the keys to our own spiritual survival is to look at the stories of the people in God's Word and look at what was the thinking behind their actions. Good examples were due to thinking the right way. Bad examples were due to thinking the wrong way. It's either the mind of Christ or the carnal mind. Can we identify which it is? You know, you can ask yourself a question. Do you think we learn better from good examples or from bad examples? I suppose you could make a case for either, and that's the point. We can learn from either one, can't we? Depends on which hits home more deeply. The Bible's filled with both of them, which tells us that God knows we can learn from both of them. That's why he lets them all be recorded. Good examples are to teach us and inspire us. Bad examples are also teaching us, but they're warning us of this is what can happen if you don't control your thinking. What we're going to look at today with the life of Saul is a poor example in the Bible. We can look at it because it ties in so clearly to so many of those points that I rattled off of 23, and we could make more about thinking. We look at how not to lead. Saul was the king of Israel. It's a story about how not to lead, and it begins with how not to think, because that's where it starts. Saul had a fatal flaw that doomed his reign and doomed his time as king. It was in the way he thought. And the Bible tells us, the scriptures tell us, that the first three kings of Israel all reigned for 40 years. 40 years. Saul for 40, David for 40, Solomon for 40. Do you realize how early in his reign Saul was told, you will not, your dynasty, your reign will not continue. You will be removed from the throne. How far into that 40 years reign was that example? We're going to find that it was 2 years in. He had 38 more years on the throne. In fact, when he was told that his kingdom would not continue, David was not even born yet. Because David was 30 when he became king, and Saul had 38 years yet to reign when he was told that the kingdom would be removed from him. David wouldn't be born for another 8 years. Isn't that astonishing? You think about it. So let's go through. We're going to focus on him, even though, of course, there are some other very interesting and instructive stories of other people that are woven into his life, primarily David, his own son Jonathan, case in point, too. But what he was doing, and most importantly, why he was doing it, is what ought to interest us. Where did either his character flaws or his strengths of character come from? Saul did exhibit some good choices and good decisions. There were times when he reacted correctly. But overall, his life is a pattern of poor choices. So we're not going to go through all the details. We're just going to try to focus especially on his thinking. His story really begins in 1 Samuel chapter 8. This is really kind of a background story as to how Saul comes to be selected as the king. It's interesting that the story of Saul really begins with the thinking of other people. The whole reason that he ever came to the position of being king is because of the way the people of Israel as a whole were thinking. It says, "It came to pass when Samuel was old," 1 Samuel 8:1, "that he made his sons judges over Israel." Now, Israel had been ruled or guided by judges for generations. Different judges in different parts of the land. They weren't ever over the whole country, over the whole nation generally, although Samuel certainly had more influence than most because he was also serving in the priesthood. The name of his firstborn was Joel. The name of his second, Abijah. They were judges in Beersheba. But his sons did not walk in his ways. They turned aside after dishonest gain, they took bribes, and they perverted justice. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together, and they came to Samuel at Ramah, and they said, "Look, you are old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all the nations." So the story of Saul begins with how the nation was thinking. They wanted a king. They didn't want to continue the pattern of judges ruling over them. They were content, apparently, with Samuel. He was a righteous man. But they were very blunt when they told him, "Look, Samuel, you're getting old. You cannot live forever. And your sons do not follow your example. Now, we want a king, just like all the other nations around us." So that's how it started. The elders of the country, the elders of the nation, somehow became convinced that this was the answer. Now, Samuel warned them what would happen. Obviously, he felt personally rejected, but God said, "Don't feel that way, Samuel. They haven't rejected you. They've rejected me." And so in verse 9, he says, "Therefore, heed their voice," God says. However, you shall solemnly forewarn them and show them the behavior of the king who will reign over them. And he does. Beginning in verse 11, he told them, verse 10, the ones who ask him for a king, he said, "This will be the behavior of the king who will reign over you." And you go through that. He talks about he'll take your sons, appoint them for his own chariots to be his horsemen. Some will run before his chariots. He'll appoint captains over his thousands and fifties, some to plow his ground, reap his harvest, some to make his weapons and equipment for his chariots. He'll take your daughters to be perfumers, cooks, and bakers. He'll take the best of your fields, your vineyards, your olive groves, and give them to his servants. He'll take a tenth of your grain and your vintage and give it to his officers and servants. Of course, that wouldn't negate the tithe that needed to go to the priesthood. You know, this is an additional tax. And he will take your men servants and your maid servants and your finest young men and donkeys and put them to his work. He'll take a tenth of your sheep, and you will be his servants, and you will cry out in that day because of your king whom you have chosen for yourselves, and the Lord will not hear you in that day. That was the warning. Pretty straight talk. Interesting description. You know, when we first find a description of the man, Saul, chapter 8 is just the background. We don't have the man yet, just the idea that they want a king. But when we first meet the description of Saul in chapter 9, what is he being described as? What kind of a description do we have? Do we have a description of his physical appearance or of his character? What do we have? Well, I think we all know. Why? Here's an interesting quote from Expositor's Bible Commentary. It says, though God actually appointed Saul, Saul did not, in the final analysis, represent God's choice, but the people's choice. The Israelites wanted one who was grand in appearance and in whom they could rejoice with fleshly pride. So God picked for them the man who in all Israel came nearest to fulfilling their idea of what a king should be. How interesting. Later on, when God chose David, he didn't go by appearance. Remember, Samuel went to the house of Jesse and he was told it would be one of Jesse's sons. And he started with the oldest and he went all the way down and he finally said, the man who's going to be king is not here. And they said, well, he said, don't you have any other sons? He said, well, yeah, the runt of the litter, you know, the little guy, he's out with a sheep. Samuel said, I won't sit down until he's been brought here. As soon as David came in, God let him know, this is the one, anoint him with the oil to be king. So God looked on the heart. That's not to say necessarily that Saul was a bad man. It wasn't that he was evil like some others. The words that are used to describe him, choice and handsome, in verse 2 of chapter 9, the Hebrew word tob, T-O-B, is used in the expression boker tob, which means good morning, or erev tob, good evening. It just means good, though it can include the idea of handsomeness. It isn't necessarily that he was an evil man. It's just that the description is all about what he looked like. As you go a little further, we're not just going to go in detail through the story because it continues for several chapters. We find that in chapter 10, Samuel gives him a sign that God will actually work with him, that he will be anointed. Verse 1, Samuel took a flask of oil and poured it on his head and kissed him and said, isn't it because the Eternal has anointed you commander over his inheritance? He describes, he says, when you've departed from me today, you'll find two men by Rachel's tomb, and they'll say to you, the donkeys that you found went to look for have been found. And he's told that there will be certain things happening, that he will see this happening, and he will see that. You'll go from there and come to the terebinth tree of Tabor, verse 3. Three men going up to God at Bethel will meet you. They'll be carrying three young goats and loaves of bread and a skin of wine. They'll greet you and give you some of the loaves of bread, and you'll receive it. You'll come to the hill of God where the Philistine garrison is. You'll meet a group of prophets coming down from the high place with a stringed instrument, tambourine, and so on. And the Spirit of God will come upon you. Or it doesn't say it will be dwelling in you. It says it will come upon you. And it says, and you will prophesy with them, and you will be turned into another man. It will be as if God is working with you in a way. And you'll feel like you're different. In fact, when all this happened, we find in verse 12, somebody who sort of knew who he was, knew him, verse that says, a man from there answered and said, but who's their father? Therefore it became a proverb, is Saul also among the prophets? Is Saul going to be a preacher too? You know, he was just so different from anyone who had known him before. God gave him every chance. He allowed him to be able to see things a little differently. Again, it isn't that his spirit was in Saul, but he was working with Saul. In much the same way, when God calls someone now, before you're baptized, God actually can work with a person, even though you don't have God's spirit in you yet. So we would assume that it was something like that for Saul, that God was working with him. He gave him every chance to succeed. His ascension to the throne actually came in three stages. We've already seen that Samuel anointed him. Then there's the public drawing of lots in a ceremony later on to show to the people God's choice. And then in chapter 11, we have a public confirmation by the nation. But it's interesting, in chapter 10, when they were looking for him, after the lots had revealed that it would be Saul, he was hiding. It says, when he had caused the tribe of Benjamin to come near, Saul, the son of Kish, was chosen. They inquired, has the man come here yet? And God answered, there he is, hidden among the equipment. The old King James, I think, uses the word stuff. He was hidden among the stuff. So they ran and brought him from there, and when he stood among the people, he was taller than any of the people from his shoulders upwards. And that's exactly what the people wanted. The question is, what was motivating Saul? Maybe sometimes in the past we've said, well, he was humble, he had humility. But was it humility, or was it timidity, or was it an inferiority complex? Mr. Kylo asked that question, and he said later events in his life, you can't tell just from this event, but he said later events in his life prove that it was most likely an inferiority complex. The way Saul reacted, for example, when others around him experienced certain things. How did he react, for example, when his own son Jonathan was used to deliver the Israelites and to have great success against the Philistines? He had made a rash vow that no one would eat or drink until thus and such happens. Jonathan, we remember, hadn't heard that discussion. He and his armor bearer had been used to gain a great victory over the Philistines, just the two of them, and he ate some wild honey because he was tired, and his father was going to put him to death. And the people intervened and said, not a chance. He has delivered a great victory for Israel this day, and the people, the other soldiers surrounded him, and Saul backed down. How did Saul react when David was used by God to deliver the nation from the threat of Goliath? Which, by the way, if Saul was the biggest and strongest and toughest guy in the whole kingdom, who should have been going out to face Goliath? Not a little shepherd boy with a sling and some stones. The king should have been. And what happened when David became idolized by the nation? Well, Saul lost it. It's interesting. It didn't have to be this way. You know, early on in chapter 11, when Saul is sort of confirmed by the people, there was an incident that arose that brought him to the fore, and it was a need for a military intervention. And Saul, in my Bible it says at the beginning of chapter 11, saves Jabesh-Gilead. And they enemies had surrounded the city. They said they needed to send messengers. One of the messengers came to Gibeah, verse 4, and told the news in the hearing of the people. The people lifted up their voices. There was Saul coming from the herd in the field, and he said, what troubles the people that they weep? They told him the words of the men of Jabesh. Then the Spirit of God came upon Saul when he heard this news, and his anger was greatly aroused. This was a righteous indignation. It was spurred by God's Spirit influence on him. And so he intervened. He went and took care of the situation. It talks about the intervention, the success. Verse 12, some of the people then were angry with the ones who hadn't wanted Saul to be king. The people said to Samuel, who is he who said, shall Saul reign over us? Bring the people that we may put them to death. And Saul intervened. He says, not a man shall be put to death this day, for today God has accomplished salvation in Israel. That was a good response. Those were right thoughts. He had a chance. Come, Samuel said, come, let us go to Gilgal and renew the kingdom there. So they went to Gilgal. They made Saul king before the Eternal in Gilgal. They made sacrifices of peace offerings before God, and there Saul and all the men of Israel rejoiced greatly. So he had some positive starts. Chapter 12, I won't go through all of it, but we have Samuel's address to Israel, to the people. He's come all the way down. He warns them. He tells them what to expect. He cautions them to always follow God. Verse 13 says, here is the king whom you have chosen and whom you have desired. And take note, the Eternal has set a king over you. But if you fear God and serve him and obey his voice, don't rebel against his commandment, both you and the king who reigns over you will continue following the Lord your God. That's what the goal was. Verse 24, only serve the Lord and serve him in truth with all your heart, for consider with what great things he has done for you. But if you still do wickedly, you shall be swept away, both you and your king. That was the warning. That's about thinking, about how we think. The next chapter records the turning point in Saul's reign, one of them, a major turning point. And we read about it. It's not even the one about the Amalekites. That's maybe the one we think about. That happened later, quite a bit later. But in chapter 13, we find that we have a situation developing. Reigned 1 year, it says, when he had reigned 2 years over Israel. So now he's 2 years into his 40-year reign. Saul chose for himself 3,000 men of Israel, 2,000 with Saul in Michmash in the mountains of Bethel, 1,000 were with Jonathan in Gibeah of Benjamin. The rest he sent away, every man to his tent. So a small force. Jonathan attacked the garrison of the Philistines that was in Geba. The Philistines heard of it. Saul blew the trumpet, saying, let the Hebrews hear. So they attacked the garrison. The people were called together. The Philistines gathered, verse 5, there were 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen. The men of Israel saw they were in danger, for the people were distressed. The people hid in caves, thickets, rocks, holes, pits. Some of the Hebrews crossed over the Jordan to the land of Gad and Gilead. As for Saul, he was still in Gilgal. All the people followed him trembling. So they want God to intervene for them. Here's what happens. Then he waited 7 days, according to the time set by Samuel. But Samuel didn't come to Gilgal, and the people were scattered from him. People are drifting away. The army is melting into the rocks and caves and holes. So Saul said, bring a burnt offering and peace offerings here to me. And he offered the burnt offering. Now Saul was king, but as king, he did something he had no right to do. This was an action that should have been reserved for a priest, not for a king. We're asking ourselves to think about not what he did, but why did he do it? Why would he do this? It was certainly an elevated sense of self. It was a devalued sense of respect for God. You know, we can learn a lot about his character. Now it happened as soon as he'd finished offering the burnt offering that Samuel came. And Saul went out to meet him and that he might greet him. And Samuel said, what have you done? And Saul said, when I saw that the people were scattered from me and that you didn't come within the time appointed and that the Philistines gathered together at Michmash, then I said, the Philistines will now come down on me at Gilgal, and I have not made supplication to the Lord. That sounds great. I can't go to battle unless I get God's blessing. Therefore, I felt compelled, and I offered a burnt offering. Samuel said to Saul, you have done foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you. For now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. But now your kingdom shall not continue. Remember, this is 2 years into his reign. The Lord has sought for himself a man after his own heart. And we might add, who had not yet been born. And the Lord has commanded him to be commander over his people because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you. And Samuel arose and went up from Gilgal to Gibeah of Benjamin. A really revealing incident. Tells a lot about his character. God doesn't reject somebody over an act committed in ignorance. There's a lot more to the story than appears on the surface. You know, look at the words he said. He justified himself up and down to Samuel. I have all kinds of reasons for doing what I did. You know, Samuel hadn't come. You hadn't come. The people were scattering. I needed to fight. I hadn't consulted with God yet. I forced myself. It was against my better judgment. You know, that's all in there. Brethren, we need to ask ourselves and learn lessons from it. What is our thinking when we make excuses for poor behavior or for sins? What is our thinking? That's the lesson for us that we're concerned about. Are we driving down the path of Saul, or are we living like David? Saul was foolishly relying on himself, and Samuel told him so. It didn't mean when Samuel said, your kingdom shall not continue, didn't mean that it would quickly come to an end. He had 38 more years on the throne. But as Samuel explained to him, God would have established his kingdom forever if he had shown that his thinking was totally yielded to God. But instead, he showed that his thinking was to be more concerned about what the people thought and about how he appeared to others. Chapter 14 includes the other confrontation with the Philistines. Saul's rash oath, the one that I've already referred to. In order to save time, I won't go through that in a great amount of detail. But you see that Jonathan was different from his father. Jonathan was You can understand why Jonathan later became such good friends with David, even though there was quite an age difference between them. They became very close friends. Jonathan and his armor bearer come out of hiding. They confront a small garrison of the Philistines. They strike down about 20, kill them, and they strike fear into the enemy. Saul calls the roll for the army, and his son's missing. And he has made this rash oath, we see, in later on in the chapter. Saul had, you know, it wasn't wise thinking. If you've got an army that needs to go out to battle, do you really want them to go out on empty stomachs and hungry? I mean, it wasn't smart on so many levels. He calls for the ark, Saul does, in the chapter to ask again for some kind of guidance. Verse 18 of chapter 14, Saul said to Ahijah, "Bring the ark of God here," for at that time the ark was with the children of Israel. Now it happened, it says, verse 19, while Saul talked to the priest, that the noise which was in the camp of the Philistines continued to increase. So Saul said to the priest, "Withdraw your hand." Interesting phrase. What's he doing here? Saul and all the people who were with him assembled, and they went to the battle, and indeed every man's sword was against his neighbor, and there was very great confusion. So we find that the Philistines were in terrible confusion. Well, the noise that Saul heard was the noise of the Philistines self-destructing. So in the middle of asking for the priest to get God's blessing, he hears the noises, and he stops the priest. It was as if he said, "That's okay, stop. We don't need God's help after all." You know, what was the thinking here? What was going through the man's mind? Why did he stop the priest? He apparently realized the battle's already going Israel's way. Maybe somehow sensed that God had already intervened. It was now like, never mind, I know what to do. You can stop. You don't have to ask God for help anymore. It's a strange, strange thing. And then he makes this rash oath in verse 24. You notice how he places the wording. The men of Israel were distressed that day, for Saul had placed the people under oath, saying, "Cursed is the man who eats any food until evening before I have taken my vengeance on my enemies." Those are Saul's words. Do you see some problems with the thinking? So none of the people tasted food. Here they came through the forest. There was honey dripping on the ground from a tree. Jonathan hadn't heard his father, verse 27. So he and his armor bearer there, they pick it up and eat some honey. And then, as you go through the chapter, you find that Saul is going to kill his own son when he finds out. He has a casting of lots. It determines, he says, "You, all the people on one side, Jonathan and myself will be on the other." The lot showed it was either Saul or Jonathan. Saul said he knew it wasn't him. "What have you done?" So Jonathan told him. Verse 43 said, "I only tasted a little honey with the end of the rod that was in my hand. Now I must die." Saul answered, "God do so and more also, for you shall surely die, Jonathan." What kind of a man is this? What is the thinking? But the people said to Saul, "Shall Jonathan die who has accomplished this great salvation in Israel? Certainly not. As God lives, not one hair of his head shall fall to the ground, for he has worked with God this day." So the people rescued Jonathan, and he did not die. So Saul returned from pursuing the Philistines, and the Philistines went to their own place. Time begins to expire here now. Verse 47 through 52, just Saul established his sovereignty. It's like there's an interim here where the Bible just records time goes on, events continue. So that this event with the sparing of King Agag and the Amalekites, one we're probably more familiar with in chapter 15, could have been much later. And this is, again, it reveals a problem. You know, it's interesting, this whole issue with Jonathan and the oath and the requirement that they not eat. You stop and think about, why was Saul so insistent on this oath? God had obviously used Jonathan to bring Israel a great victory, as you read the account. That didn't matter to Saul. Maybe his success did matter. Maybe deep down inside with Saul, we're going to see this come up again with David much later. The success of other people bothers this man. But in this case, we see the thinking process of a carnal mind, not one on whom God's Spirit had come. He was the king. He was in charge. He gave an order. Jonathan not only disobeyed the order, he even criticized it. When an insecure person is in power, even the most innocent or accidental things can be seen as a threat to their authority. And they feel they have to protect their authority at all costs. When you create a conflict, as Saul did, on the basis of authority, there are no winners. Saul was prepared to execute his own son. And this is something that commonly happens with insecure people. You know, there's a principle here. You got to always walk on eggshells around people who are overly concerned about their authority. You know, there's a modern day example Mr. Kylo cited in his presentation in the New Testament. In both Ephesians 5:22 and Colossians 3:18, it says, "Wives, submit to your own husbands." As he pointed out, ladies, he said, you have no obligation to submit until you give him the office of being your husband. He said, if you agree to marry him, you are bestowing upon him the authority to lead the family. When you say, I do, you recognize that. So Mr. Kylo said, be careful to whom you give that authority. You need to know, he says, how that man thinks about authority and responsibility and humility and willingness to listen, how he reacts when he makes a mistake. Those are all things that ladies certainly need to think about before they agree to marriage because of the biblical conditions and terms that are set out. And, you know, if any man tries to say, well, I should have authority because I'm a man and you're a woman, say, ain't married you yet, buddy, and not planning to with that kind of an approach. I mean, that's just the way things are. Well, back to Saul. Time passes, end of chapter 14. We come to 15, and there another key milestone precipitated this event by character flaws. We know all about it. He is told by Samuel that time has come to avenge the injustice done to the Israelites by the Amalekites when they came out of Egypt. He's given very clear instructions. Verse 2, thus says the Lord of hosts, I will punish what Amalek did to Israel, how he laid wait for him on the way when he came up from Egypt. Now go and attack Amalek and utterly destroy all that they have and do not spare them. But kill both man and woman, infant and nursing child, ox and sheep, camel and donkey. Now we look at that and say, how awful. God is the creator of life. He will bring all these people back to life in the second resurrection when he will teach them his way. It isn't our place to criticize God's decisions or directions. Neither was it Saul's. These were the instructions. They were not unclear. But we all know what happened. Saul attacked the Amalekites, verse 7, from Havilah all the way to Shur, which is east of Egypt. He took Agag, king of the Amalekites, alive and utterly destroyed all the people on the edge of the sword. But Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep, the oxen, the fatlings, the lambs, all that was good. And they were unwilling to utterly destroy them. Interesting wording. But everything despised and worthless, that they utterly destroyed. That kind of misses the point, doesn't it? Kind of misses the point. It's interesting and it's important to note that Saul and the people were unwilling. And once again we ask, what was he thinking? Unwilling means they knew they were supposed to do this, but they made a conscious choice differently because they didn't want to do this. There had to be some sort of discussion about it. Had to be. Because the phrase is Saul and the people. Maybe there was even some kind of a debate in Saul's mind or in the minds of several of them. But, you know, it'd be easy to rationalize. Look out there and say, man, this is prime livestock. Why would we destroy them? Look at all that out there. I mean, we could sell it all to Morton Steakhouse and, you know. They were doubting God's directions. They were saying, what God said doesn't make sense. So we're going to do it differently. Then here comes the justification. Well, okay, we saved the best of the animals to sacrifice to the Lord your God. That's what he tells Samuel. Interesting phrase, to the Lord your God, isn't it? Is there a distance there? It's also interesting that what seemed more important to Saul was pleasing the people than in obeying God. It said Saul and the people were unwilling to utterly destroy them. Now it's interesting, in verse 13, Samuel went to Saul, and Saul said to him, "Blessed are you of the Eternal. I have performed the commandment of the Lord." Now he's all ready to take credit when he thinks he's done what he was supposed to do. What happens when Samuel points out to him that he hasn't done what he was supposed to do? What does he say then? Does he take the blame? Does he say, "The buck stops here, I am the king, it was my decision, I take full responsibility"? Is that what he did? Nope. Samuel said, "What then is this bleating of the sheep in my ears and the lowing of the oxen which I hear?" Small problem, Saul. Dead oxen don't moo. Dead sheep don't go baa. Saul said, "They have brought them from the Amalekites, for the people spared the best of the sheep and the oxen to sacrifice to the Lord your God, and the rest we've utterly destroyed." See what's happening here? What kind of leadership is this? Take credit when you think you got credit coming, blame somebody else when you get called on it. The thinking process. When humans seek approval from other humans, which is what Saul was clearly doing, that inevitably leads to compromising with right standards in order to keep from losing that human approval. It's inevitable. Saul is perhaps a classic example, but how many times has that been played out in human history all the way up to our own time? Question for us. Have there been times when we have wanted and when we have compromised because we wanted the approval of other people? Well, if we're honest, I suspect there have been. In those times, we were thinking more like man, not like God. More carnal, less spiritual. What the people wanted to do was irrelevant. Saul was king. Verse 20, Saul said to Samuel, "But I have obeyed the voice of the Lord, and I've gone on the mission which the Lord sent me, and I brought back Agag, king of Amalek. I've utterly destroyed the Amalekites, with one small exception. But the people took of the plunder, the sheep and the oxen, the best of the things which should have been utterly destroyed, to sacrifice to the Lord your God in Gilgal." Finally, he says, "Well, it should have been destroyed, but the people did it." But he was the king. He had all the authority. Then Samuel said, "Has the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Eternal? To obey is better than sacrifice, to heed than the fat of rams. For rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft." Some translations don't even have "is as." It just says rebellion, the sin of witchcraft. Stubbornness, iniquity, and idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Eternal, he also has rejected you from being king. It was even firmed up more now here. Saul had a problem with his thinking. Rebellion and stubbornness are ways of thinking, and they're not always obvious to the person thinking that way. Partial obedience isn't the same as full obedience. Saul seemed to think it was. He was argumentative. He was still abdicating responsibility, blaming others. All kinds of thing going on here. It's interesting that phrase about rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft, or rebellion is the sin of witchcraft. What is the connection between the two? Witchcraft involves submitting yourself to and calling upon demonic powers to accomplish your will. Rebellion is yielding to the demonic way of thinking, which was at the core of the first rebellion, Satan's rebellion, Lucifer's rebellion against God. That's why he says rebellion is the sin of witchcraft. Witchcraft is calling upon demonic powers to accomplish your will. Rebellion is yielding to that same way of thinking. That's why he said that. A witch doesn't control the powers that he or she uses. They only try to harness them for their own purposes. So ultimately, they have to yield themselves to demonic powers to get what they want. The person who rebels is also yielding to the same demonic powers in an effort to get what he or she wants. That's why it's made that way. Stubbornness, he says, stubbornness is as iniquity and idolatry. Iniquity means lawlessness or breaking God's law, which is sin. So stubbornness automatically leads to sin because we insist on our will and we don't yield to God's will. To stubbornly insist on our own way is to refuse to yield to anyone or anything else, including God. And that is idolatry, because we put ourselves before God and it leads automatically to sin. So that's why these things are stated that way. It's important for us to understand that you and I, as humans, we might see some sin as kind of small. We even have a phrase like, well, it was only a little white lie. Meaning, well, it's not quite as bad as a lie that's got gray in it, you know, or so completely dark, it's blacker than a cave, that you can't see anything. It's a lie. It isn't telling the truth. God doesn't see it the same way we do because he sees where that way of thinking will lead. And that's what we're trying to analyze today. Saul's way of thinking and what it led to. You know, it isn't enough just to stack up the deeds of say, well, I did this, I did that, I did the other. What did Jesus say in the Sermon on the Mount? He says, many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, didn't we do all these wonderful works? Didn't we do this? Didn't we do that in your name? And he'll say, I never knew you. Depart from me, you who work iniquity. Matthew 7, 21 to 23. It's the thinking, the attitude, the heart. What did Christ say about the Pharisees? He said, outside, you look all beautiful, like a whited sepulcher, you know, a painted mausoleum. But inside, it's all filled with dead men's bones and putrefaction and corruption. You know, a coat of paint can't hold together a house that has a rotten structure. It just won't work. This entire chapter 15 is a lot of insight into Saul's thinking, and it ends in the last verse where we find that he will never see Samuel again. Samuel went no more to see Saul until the day of his death. Nevertheless, Samuel mourned for Saul, and the Lord regretted that he had made Saul king over Israel. Interesting descriptions. When David was anointed king in the next chapter, we immediately begin to have problems. There's not a lot of time to go through all of this. Again, the point is we're trying to analyze Saul's thinking. The difference between the two is striking. Verse 7 of 1 Samuel 16, the Lord said to Samuel, do not look at his appearance. That's exactly how Saul was chosen. You know, that's what the people wanted, so that's what God gave him. He was taller than all the rest of the people, for it says head and shoulders above all the rest of the people. He looked great. He looked kingly. David was a shepherd boy. Don't look at his appearance or at the height of his stature, because I have refused him, speaking of Jesse's older sons. For the Lord does not see as man sees. For man looks at the outward appearance, but the eternal looks at the heart. And we eventually find in verse 12, so they brought David in, and he was ruddy with bright eyes and good looking, and the Lord said, arise and anoint him, for this is the one. Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the midst of his brothers, and the Spirit of the Lord came upon David from that day forward. We know it did more than come upon him. Later on, we know that it was in him because he pleaded with God not to take it from him when he repented in Psalm 51. So this is the anointing of David. We know the rest of the story. I'm not going to take a lot of time with it. Chapter 17 is the story of David and Goliath. One of Saul's greatest challenges, and the greatest challenges to the nation, was solved by a shepherd boy who wasn't probably even 20 years old yet, probably still a teenager. Saul is the logical one to go out. You know, he was the king. Or if not him, you know, someone that he appoints, one of his great mighty men of war, somebody. But the result, of course, you know what happened. God gave the victory to David. He delivers the nation from Goliath and the Philistines, and Saul begins to resent him. He begins to have all kinds of problems with him. He wanted to give his older daughter to him, Merab. He said, well, Michael's the one who appeals to me, so He sets a rather expensive bounty. He wanted the foreskins of 100 Philistines brought, so David brought him 200. And it was a rough time to live. But Saul was determined to get rid of David. He was determined to get rid of him. You know, most of us probably wouldn't take the approach of, you know, I'm going to get rid of this guy, so I'll let my daughter marry him, and I'll demand an exorbitant dowry price. It's interesting. All the way to the end of Saul's life, he would still see David as a competitor and a threat. How did David view Saul? How did David view himself when Saul was still alive? He never viewed himself as anything except Saul's faithful servant. There were occasions where he could have killed Saul had he chosen. And he refused. Some of his own men, some of his own armored soldiers with him, wanted him to kill Saul. They said, God's delivered you into his hand. And David said, I will not raise my hand against the Lord's anointed. When his time comes, he will die of it, you know, in his sleep or disease or in battle, but I will not raise my hand against God's anointed. Saul's emphasis was on appearance. He viewed life through the lens of competition. David was a threat. People who look at life that way, they see everybody as a threat to their authority. They look at life through that lens. In any conflict, these kind of people, like Saul, have a greater need to win than to reconcile. He didn't want to be reconciled to David, even when he would occasionally speak those words. When David didn't kill him, and he called to him, and he said, Saul, whose corner of a garment is this? Who does this robe belong to? I could have killed you. And Saul was all contrite. You've been more righteous than I. Come down. Didn't happen, did it? He was afraid of David. It says so in chapter 18 and verse 12. It says, Saul was afraid of David because God was with him but had departed from Saul. It says it again. He was afraid of him, verse 15. So his quest to destroy David begins. Well, it goes on and on. We won't go through all of that. It gets much worse. Saul eventually even consults a medium, a witch, even though he had banned them. It just, his whole life is spinning out of control. In the end, when you finally come down to it, how did Saul's life end? Well, we know it ended in battle. Yes and no. But essentially, Saul took his own life. Saul took his own life. He called to the armor bearer in chapter 31. We find the tragic end of Saul and his sons. The Philistines fought against Israel. The men of Israel fled from before the Philistines, fell slain on Mount Gilboa. Then the Philistines followed hard after Saul and his sons. The Philistines killed Jonathan, Abinadab, and Malchishua, Saul's sons. Now the battle became intense against Saul. The archers hit him. He was severely wounded by the archers. And then Saul said to his armor bearer, draw your sword and thrust me through with it, lest these uncircumcised men come and thrust me through and abuse me. But his armor bearer would not, for he was greatly afraid. Therefore Saul took a sword and fell on it. Saul committed suicide on the battlefield. When his armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he also fell on his sword and died with him. So Saul, his three sons, his armor bearer, and all his men died together that same day. So it's a tragic end to a life of a man who had the opportunity to have God guide him and lead him. And according to what Samuel said, God would have made his kingdom endure. But just 2 years into his reign, because his thinking was askew, because he was more focused on pleasing the people and maintaining his authority, and he got thinking the wrong way. It's an example to us, brethren. We can learn from this too. Just like Paul said in the New Testament, all these things were written to us for examples upon whom the ends of the ages have come. You know, in trying to explain Saul's actions, we have a very clear description and an analysis and an explanation, a diagnosis for things in our day and age. It's called PTSD, post-traumatic stress syndrome or disorder. You know, Mr. Kylo suggested, he said, Saul had PTSD, but it stood for poor thinking spiritual disorder. Poor thinking spiritual disorder. And it led him into all kinds of problems. You know, Albert Einstein once famously said this statement. Einstein said, "We cannot solve problems by using the same kind of thinking we used when we created them." And that's worth thinking about, isn't it? We cannot solve problems by using the same kind of thinking we used when we created them. It takes a different kind of thinking to get out of it. Einstein spotted the problem, but he didn't have the solution. Because the solution is the way God thinks. The solution is, once again, Philippians 2 and verse 5. "Let this mind be in you, which was in Jesus Christ." When God offers us His Spirit, He's offering us access to the way He thinks. Why is that so important? You've heard the phrase, "As a man thinks, so is he." Then if we think like God, what will we become? We will become godly in our approaches, in our thinking. If we think like humans, what will we become? We will become carnal in our approaches. Romans 8, verses 6 and 7. So we need to think about this. I'd encourage you to take this little case history study we did today, and we skimmed over lots of it. I mean, there's much more. We started in 1 Samuel 8, and Saul takes his own life in 1 Samuel 31. So there are really 24 chapters, essentially, in the Bible devoted to the life of King Saul and the others who interact with him. There's a lot in there that we can learn from. And we just hit the high spots today, but use it when you look at the lives of others throughout the Bible, maybe some who we don't have as much information about. Saul, we've got a lot of information. And then take a look at our own lives. Turn the mirror on ourselves. One of the most important things we can do is when we pray to ask God, "Help me to learn to think like you. I want to grow up to be just like my dad." Thank you.